Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is artist and teacher Carol Spence. Spence has a Master's of Art in Teaching from the Rhode Island School of Design. As an artist, she is focused on mixed media and illustration, and her work has been exhibited both locally and regionally. Over the last year, she has shown work at the State of the Art Gallery, Ithaca's Artists Market, and the Mostly Blue Show at the Community School of Music and Arts. She has also created original artwork for the Kitchen Theater's main stage productions, and for the last 22 years, Spence has been an art teacher and department chair at the Ithaca City School District. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, did your interest in art and illustration begin as a child, or did you have to develop this interest as you got older?
No, I think as a child, you know, I always loved playing with crayons and paper and scissors and glue and could get completely absorbed in doing that. My older brother Carl was a very visual person and would draw a lot, so I had an opportunity to kind of emulate and do work that I thought would be fun with him. I spent 12 years in Catholic school, and we really didn't have extensive art programs, but I lived in Brooklyn, and so we had access to museums and art all over the neighborhood and very close by. So that was certainly a presence in my life.
Wow, that's great. Now, how did you decide which mediums and what kind of materials you were going to use? Because you've ended up as an illustrator and doing visual art. And tell us how you developed that.
Yeah, some of it is practicality, what I had available and what I would like to experiment with. The mixed media aspect was always very attractive to me, although I worked primarily as a printmaker when I was in school at Rhode Island and previous to that at SUNY Cortland. Mm. And they have a wonderful art program, and I did a lot of printmaking there. And I really like the idea of repetition and pattern that offered, and just subtle differences that could happen with printmaking. But then I started drawing on the prints and collaging, and it was nice just to open it up and respond to the material in any way that it would suggest in that process.
Uh-huh. So you liked actually feeling the materials as well.
Yeah, and things happen, you know, as you're working. The materials, if you pay attention, and I talk to students about this a lot, if you just have a fixed idea of what you want as the outcome, you miss some wonderful opportunities and surprises and even accidents that happen during the process. And if you pay attention, there's things that emerge from the media and from color and overlays that suggest new directions. And so then you might add different materials, or you might take it in a whole nother subject matter. So there's a nice exchange and conversation that happens with mixed media.
Yeah, I'll bet there is. And you have to be unafraid to fail if you're experimenting this with so many different...
Yeah, you have to be ready to make a lot of bad art. you know, I think if you get too precious about hoping that every piece is going to be on the wall, that's really not the journey that you want to make. It's really just a process of understanding your own experience and how you learn and how you make decisions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they develop a beautiful document, and sometimes not so much.
Yeah. Now you say, as an illustrator, that you use remembered landscapes and birds and bits of text to transform personal experience into metaphor. I think that's a beautiful...
That's pretty poetic, huh?
That's a beautiful way of putting that. Tell us, you're trying to bring back nostalgia for some people, or just let them dream what they need to from your work?
I think during the course of a day, any of us have these little bits and pieces of visual imagery or words or phrases, and I've always liked to hold on to them a little bit, because if they stick in my mind, there's something that resonates, and then it suggests the possibility of playing with it subject matter wise. I don't look for the story, I just see what I'm thinking about or what happens to be present in my life. I went through a period of time where I was dreaming a lot about water. I grew up around it a lot, and so big waves were always part of my images, and I wasn't really sure what it meant, but I thought I should probably play with that and explore it. And most recently, work that I've done that I think is now at the Jewel Box. Mickey Roof has a series that I did over the summer where I was dreaming about tornadoes.
I noticed that.
And included them as part of it. So I think what happens is that they become very iconic and symbolic without me trying to twist and force them into a storyline. And they suggest things for me in my experience, and then I think people respond to their own memories or dreams or experience of that, and it has different interpretations, which is what you hope for.
Yeah, yeah. Your work is nostalgic to me. It does call up poetic images and maybe scenes that I made up but just wanted to see, you know?
Oh, that's great.
That kind
of
dreaming kind of thing.
And hopefully that even changes. I mean, I look at work that I've done or other people's work that I have in my home, and depending on where I am at any given point in my life or even a mood during that day, I might have a different response to that piece and what it evokes and provokes in me.
Yeah, yeah. That's the great thing about art. Absolutely. Now, how has your own art changed with the advent of the high-tech world? And it seems to have permeated all of our lives, especially artists.
Yeah.
How has your art changed through the years?
Not radically, really. I try to keep it fairly low-tech. Again, some of what I do has evolved because it has to be compatible with the rest of my life. I want to be consistent with being able to be productive. Teaching and teaching art certainly is very compatible. They inform each other very nicely. But I still work in layers. I don't have full days and endless time to develop very large pieces in a concentrated time. So I might start ideas and make notes and do a little research and drawings and then start a layer of color or pattern or a monoprint and then put it in the drawer and go back to work and take it out again, work for 20 minutes, a half hour, an hour. Obviously, over vacation times, I have a little bit more to indulge, but that kind of process of layering really allows me to develop a number of pieces over a period of time. The scale is also compatible to what I have available in a home studio to support that.
Are you like many writers I talk to say they have to practice every day, they have to write every day to keep themselves in the in the mode. Do you feel that way as an artist as well?
Boy, I'd like to say I was so disciplined about it. There are some days where it just doesn't happen. Not in that phase of the process, but I think, and I know this is true for other art teachers as well, who feel that teaching or making art is all part of the same process. And so you're always at some stage of it. When I'm working with students and I feel it's a collaboration really, and we talk about their decisions and what their intention is with a piece, it reminds me of my own work, or I respond to it in ways that obviously are visual. So I'm making decisions and kind of making choices that are going to inform what I do with my own pieces when I get to them.
Yeah.
So there's always some part of the process in motion, which is why I'm very fortunate to do what I do.
Yeah, that's lucky. That is really lucky. Now, you've been an in-house illustrator for the Kitchen Theater for a number of years. How do you work that? Of course, I assume you read the plays. How do you decide how to put the play on one little tiny placard?
Yeah. It's been such a wonderful experience to be able to work and support the Kitchen. The people there are so inspiring to me, and theater itself is, you know, an art form that I so admire. So this was a great opportunity to collaborate. Like anything else, you wish you had endless time and opportunities to let it evolve slowly. But like most things, you don't have a lot of time, and things need to happen quickly, and changes happen at the last minute. And what often happens is that, you know, Rachel needs to do some of her own research and reading and then find out what's available.
And you're talking about Rachel Lampert, the artistic director.
Yes. And so she'll actually let me know maybe in April or May, and I need to have all the pieces by June. So I think become, if not comfortable, at least embracing of the idea that time is not going to be there. I can't become precious about them. And it's exciting in a way to work that way. There's always time as part of the media. You know, if I have to work quickly, I come up with an idea and I have to be more intuitive about it rather than reworking.
But do you read the plays?
I don't read the whole plays. I've asked Rachel to do a synopsis. I also ask her, because what I want to represent is not my interpretation of the play, but how she sees it. So I ask her if there are some key elements, the core storyline, or, you know, what are the highlights? Are there any symbolic things that might appear? So she gives me the texture of it. And I do have access to the whole play, so if that's not enough, I can go back into it. But there's often not time to read the whole play. And again, I want her viewpoint. The illustration has to serve the play, has to serve the director.
Your illustrations are great. Yeah. And they seem to depict the play so well. To me, I've looked at them and said, oh, yes, I've seen that Tennessee Williams play, and that's exactly what it, you know, the poster should look like.
Oh, that's great. It's wonderful to hear that, because you don't know, you know, anything else, you put them out and hope that they go beyond my own personal feeling and become a little more universal for an audience, and that's successful for me.
It works. Now, I want to talk about your role as a teacher, and I've always loved children's art. Tell us how you inspire children and get them to realize that art is a big part of life, not just a little pastime in some ways.
Well, I've been teaching at Ithaca High School now for 22 years, so I'm teaching at the high school level, grades 9 through 12. I work as a coordinator for the whole district, kindergarten through high school, in terms of curriculum and working with the teachers and supporting them. In my role as a teacher at the high school, one of the things that I feel really strongly about is trying to educate my colleagues as well as my students and the community that art is a way of knowing for students, a way of knowing their own learning process and of understanding the world around them. And the art piece itself, the products, are documents of the decisions that they make and how they move through an idea. And they're beautiful documents, and so I think sometimes that's what people feel is the focus, and that's what students feel is the focus. But we really try to emphasize at the high school that it's the visual thinking aspect that makes it so relevant in their lives, because that's going to apply to everything. There's very few students who will actually choose art as a career, but living an artful life is an extraordinary experience and a way to be present and fully participate and bring your own personal connections to your life. So that's what ideally we would love to have students understand, experience, and take on.
I think that's interesting that you said you're also educating your colleagues, because I always think of art as also a touchstone to the whole culture. And you can teach history with it, and you can teach current affairs.
Obviously, you can teach the political aspect
of country.
It is. You know, I'm a very big advocate, clearly, of public education. And one of the challenges that we have, budget, of course, is always one of them. Mm-hmm. But that's ongoing, and you adapt, and you have to be creative. But what's really challenging, I think, is the state perspective on assessment and looking at how children are assessed throughout their educational experience and what they choose to assess students on. And so the tests and assessments that kids have to deal with and that teachers have to embrace in their own curriculum.
So you're talking about outside of the arts.
Outside of the arts impacts the whole program, the holistic education you would like every student to have. So we don't always have access to a lot of students that I think would benefit most by understanding and experiencing the artistic process in their life. A lot of at-risk students are given more experience and support in math or wherever they feel that they're weak in, where, you know, maybe some of the issues are finding a sense of community at a school that they don't feel connected to, or being able to learn through their own learning style that they don't feel is present in some areas. So, you know, I think we can be really supportive in terms of the arts by allowing students to experience how they learn, how they connect in a personal way with the community, and then be successful while they're in an institution, which is what it is, and it's very difficult to find those connections that way. So it's a struggle, but Ithaca has been very supportive in a lot of ways. I mean, our program has remained healthy, while many have not around the state or even the country.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carol Spence. She's an artist and an art teacher. I want to talk to you about this, too. I volunteered in the schools for a while, and I worked with 4th and 5th and 6th graders for a couple of years, actually. And I've always found that the boys hated going into the art classes. Did you still find that? I mean, is that something that you have to deal with, too?
Well, I think there is, you know, certainly stereotypical things that become stereotypes because they are true to a certain extent. And I think kids, particularly around 4th grade, third, fourth grade go through a really self-conscious point in their lives where they feel challenged by making art and mm-hmm. performing. They want to be good at it right away, like anything else. And as children, little children, kindergarten, first, second grade, you don't even have to do much inspiration. Yeah. They're ready to go right away, and you put out the crayons and the paper, and you can't hold them back. But third and fourth grade, they really want to make things look good. They want them to be correct. They want to do it right. They want to be good at it. I think for boys, maybe that's a little bit more of an issue.
I think because art doesn't have the right answer.
It doesn't. You have to be very comfortable with ambiguity,
uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
which is a good thing to learn throughout your life. But it's true. Even in high school, there are students who are A students, as they think of themselves and have created that part of their lives, and they want to know, you know, how can they get an A, and what's the right answer, and you know, taking risks and making the bad art that we talked about is a little uncomfortable at first because they want to get it right away. So you have to just create an environment that is supportive and safe and model that kind of behavior yourself. We mm-hmm. often work with the students. We keep our own journals and we share what we're doing. We show them artwork that we may be involved with, that we're struggling with. So they could see it as an ongoing process rather than a product-oriented.
Yeah, or a right or wrong.
Because
that's drummed into kids. Right or wrong, we're taking a test today. You're either going to get an A or an F.
So, exactly.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me, too. Now, your husband, John, is a jewelry maker. Do you compete with each other? Do you inform each other about your work? Or?
John is so inspiring in so many ways. He went to Cooper Union and so worked as an artist and worked for artists while we were living in New York City. And I think he's reinvented himself numerous times over the years. He's currently the executive director of Better Housing for Tompkins County. And he's worked for a lot of nonprofit organizations over the years. But he always keeps that artful life
alive. He makes beautiful jewelry.
And the jewelry has been extraordinary. It's only been in the last couple of years. But we inform each other in that realm as well, because he'll share, and obviously I see what he's working on, and you know, whether it's the same vocabulary of pattern and color mm-hmm, and shape, mm-hmm. and it's great to have that feedback and that energy in the house. So
yeah,
it's great. It's not at all competitive, although maybe if you made prints, that would be different.
Now you have a statement on the City of Ithaca website about public art, and you say, you argue that the arts are an integral part of a healthy culture. Talk to us more about public art and your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I think that the public art aspect, and again, Ithaca has been great in that realm to have an ongoing exhibit out and as you walk around town is really extraordinary for
a small town.
It is. But it is a demonstration and an illustration that people are experiencing their community with a certain perspective and a certain emotion. They're expressing what they see, they're sharing it, and that's a community dialogue right there. It's also modeling for students and the rest of the community that you can live that kind of life, that personal connections are important in your work, that personal connections are important in a community, and this is one way to have that kind of dialogue and exchange. It's one of many. It's not the only thing, but it's very vibrant when you can have that as a center of the community.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Do you think public art is meant to provoke? Because a lot of public art mm-hmm. does provoke.
I don't think art needs to be pretty. You know, it's certainly lovely to have things on the wall that are colorful and enjoyable, but whether it's writing or theater or visual arts, something that moves you into another way of thinking or makes you consider another way of thinking, even if you don't agree with it. It sometimes allows you to clarify your own sense of being on many different topics, mm-hmm. and that should be an ongoing discussion with yourself and with a community. So, mm-hmm. yeah, being provocative, I think, is the best.
Do you think there's a fine line between being provocative public art-wise and propaganda?
Wow. Yeah, I guess I think those are different things.
Mm.
You know, I think there's a sense of art for art's sake rather than having a subversive message, at least in terms of my own experience and my own preference. Illustration, for example, is a form of propaganda in a positive sense, because it does serve the message of the play or the client, whatever that happens to be. So in that sense, it isn't fine art. It has a purpose beyond just what it is. So I think when you have public art, as long as that's understood, then it's a valid voice to have out there.
Do you feel yourself ever going over the line of just being an illustrator and going into fine art? Is there a fine line between?
Well, you know, for a while I didn't call myself either of those things. That always, and I think other artists have kind of, if not struggled, just avoided it, you know, calling yourself an artist or an illustrator or whatever, a painter. You know, you make stuff and you hope it stays interesting and people respond and it's provocative. But as soon as you start to label it, you feel there's expectations that you're not even sure what that means. And it's distracting sometimes. On the other hand, ultimately, it allows you to have people respond to you as an artist or as an illustrator that invites a conversation that is interesting to have. And so I don't mind that. I realize that illustration is something that I've always enjoyed doing, creating images out of my point of view or out of a story. And I think it's subtle in terms of the differences. I do fine art. I have work now that's at the State of the Art Gallery that I think you would consider fine art. It doesn't serve a storyline or a client. It's just, you know, my experience of a certain point in my life. So there's a shift. It's still personal. You're still bringing your voice, but you always have to decide who the other audience will be.
You know, I want to ask you this, too, about working with kids. A lot of therapists use art to try to figure out what's going on with a kid. Have you ever had a child create some art that made you a little bit worried about the child?
Really? Really. Every day. I mean, our studio program, which is the introduction to our program, the foundation course, we recently revived, and it's really exciting. We've put it all into a journal format. So the encouragement is to have it be a container for ideas, for writing, for visual drawings, for final pieces. So the student and I are able to see the development and the research and the experiments all in one container. Mm-hmm. And it's a tremendous thing to see that evolve over the course of the year. What also happens in that journal, in that writing, it gets more and more personal as the student feels comfortable and safe to express themselves and to put things out there that they're struggling with. So it is an opportunity to make connections and build relationships with the student, which is what you hope for as a teacher. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's an opportunity to suggest more professional support if needed. And that's available within the school as well. So there's a lot of times where kids feel, you know, I need help with this. Mm-hmm. And they feel safe to say it in that context.
When you're creating your own art, do you feel the need to make sure it's seen or bought, or would you be creating art no matter what?
Well, I'm hoping it's seen and bought, only so I could make more of it and it doesn't have to be stored in my house.
It isn't
the first thing. Mm-hmm. There's such a satisfaction about the process. And, you know, for me, it's almost like, I again, consider it like diving into water, you know, and so I'm able to go deeper and deeper when I have days like even now, this week off from school between holidays, I have some days where I can play a little bit, experiment a little bit, and feel like, you know, when I come to the surface and back into my regular day, I've been someplace that's very special, and I want to keep visiting that place.
I know a lot of artists and writers find comfort, you know, that they have this work that they can go back to. And when they have blocks, they feel lost.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I've tried to tell myself this when I do have blocks, and I'm, you know, working through some ideas right now where I'd like to push maybe into another direction or get something that energizes me and engages me in a big way. And that's a good point to be at, because it's a point where I remind myself it's a good point, as difficult as it is, because it means that you are going to move forward into something else. It's a leap of faith. It's always a leap of faith that something interesting is going to happen. You just have to start. You just have to
make
a mark.
You have to be excited about the possibility.
Yeah, you make a mark, and then you react to it, and you make another mark, and you trust that this conversation with the materials is going to provide something.
Uh-huh. Do you feel that the art world has progressed in a lot of ways in regard to women artists? I mean, there's always been talk through the decades that women artists are still not taken seriously, that, you know, their art does not garner as much money.
Yeah.
Where do you think we are with that?
Boy, you know, I don't think of myself as well-versed in the big A of art
the
world.
Big art world.
Yeah, the big
there.
Art world. One of the reasons we live in Ithaca is because it supports and allows you to try on or to practice a life that might not be available in some larger cities. And so I feel very supported here as a woman artist. And I think there are many of my colleagues who feel the same. But certainly that there still is a bias in the financial aspect and the bigger world of the art market that brings in more money for male artists.
Yeah. In this corporate world, I think a lot of artists are being eaten alive in some of those big forums anyway, regardless of whether they're men or women. Yeah.
Exactly, and that's it. It's such a struggle. I would even hate to get into the gender issue of it. Mm-hmm. I think to choose to be an artist or to have that be part of your life, it is a leap of faith, and it is a challenge to keep practicing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're almost out of time. I want to bring this up real quickly. You used to make kites.
I did.
Did you have to learn about aerodynamics and so on to do that?
Well, John and I, when we were married, we went on our honeymoon up to Montreal, and we saw a store that was selling these huge ripstop nylon kites, and we just fell in love with them. And we bought one. That was our honeymoon purchase. And then we took it apart when we got home. And we didn't know anything about aerodynamics, and we just copied it, and we made, literally, as a Christmas gift for family and friends, we made them kites. And then they liked them, and friends of theirs asked where they got the kite. And then we started doing research. So we kind of did a little bit of backwards there. We were inspired and then started learning about it. And when we came to Ithaca, we sold kites in New York City at Go Fly a Kite, which was one of the big stores that was dealing with them there, and then came up to Ithaca. And we did the Ithaca Kite Festival for a few years, which was great fun. We'd have classical music and champagne out on the hillside behind the Hangar Theater.
You have to resurrect that.
That was
tremendous.
Great. And we had a lot of people from, it became regional, and then people started traveling from different parts of the country. And it was just wonderful to do. One of the issues, like anything else, is that if that becomes a focus, when I was making kites, I started making them more and more elaborate.
Oh, yeah.
And then it wasn't profitable anymore. So I spent a lot of time. There was no way I could possibly ask a price that would garner and support that amount of time. So we had to think about either looking at it as a business and knocking them out, but it was wonderful.
Well, I think you chose the right place to be. Your artwork is wonderful.
Thank you.
We're almost out of time. Is there any contact information? Can you give a website?
IthacaArtworks.com has both my work and John's jewelry, and you can contact us through that website as well and see current work.
Oh, great. Well, Carol Spence, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This is a delightful way to end the year.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our fiscal sponsor is the New York Foundation for the Arts in Brooklyn, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.